On this episode of Skeptico, Alex talks with parapsychology researcher and well-known author on the paranormal, Lloyd Auerbach.
One of the angles in the book that's very interesting is you look at this not only from our perspective, but from the Soviet Russian perspective as well, because it was long rumored that the whole impetus for these programs was a catch-up number on the Russians. You know, somebody came back and said, hey, we just heard that through our sources, our intelligence sources, that the Russians are using psychics for espionage. We better get on this too.
It is true that we got involved in this partly because of fear that the Russians were getting somewhere. They had been spending effectively billions of dollars from the 60s onward. And there's an indication that part of how they even got involved in this, interestingly enough, is because we released intelligence that we were doing testing, which we were not doing in the early 60s, that scared the Russians into spending money and going in that direction. The idea being that this rumor that we would put out there to the Soviets would actually get them on a path of dead end. They'd spend money and time and energy on something that according to our experts, probably had no validation whatsoever. And then we start hearing things from the Soviet Union, apparently, that they were having success.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and on today's episode, we have a really interesting show centered around remote viewing and the psychic spy project that was a part of Stargate and then extended beyond that. Our guest is the very interesting Lloyd Auerbach, who has researched this extensively and has just published a new book that you're going to hear about. Our discussion certainly delves into Stargate and related projects, but also extends beyond that in some very interesting ways that we've tried to highlight, and you'll notice some of that highlighting if you go to the Skeptico website and you see a little bit of the material we've added to do so. That work is being done by me and John McGuire, who has co-produced this episode with me and has agreed to help me do this in the future. You can check out some of John's other work at the podcast Always Record and at the Sync Book. We'll get some links up to John's other work there, but it's been great having him help me on this. I think we're going to be able to get out more shows and maybe in the future find some ways to highlight some of the Skeptico interviews in some new and interesting ways. We'll have to see how that evolves. But in the meantime, enjoy this kind of far-reaching dialogue with me and Lloyd Auerbach. Today we welcome Lloyd Auerbach to Skeptico. Lloyd is the author of 9 books, including several on his work as a parapsychology field investigator, exploring reports of ghosts and haunting activities, a topic he's a recognized expert on. He's a graduate of Northwestern University and received a master's in parapsychology from JFK University, where he now teaches courses in parapsychology. He's also a magician, a mentalist, and a chocolatier, all topics I hope we have a chance to talk about. If you are familiar with parapsychology and paranormal investigations, I'm sure you've heard of our guest, Lloyd Auerbach. What I was really hoping we would focus on today, though, is a new book he's just co-authored titled ESP Wars, East and West, An Account of the Military Use of Psychic Espionage, as narrated by the key Russian and American players. Quite an interesting book. Much, much to talk about. Lloyd, welcome to Skeptico. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you, Alex.
You know where I thought, like I said in the intro there, there's just a number of strings we could pull and probably go on for quite a long time. Mm-hmm. But let's start with a thumbnail sketch of Stargate, because I think that's what people are going to be familiar with and immediately want to be hooked into, given the title of your book. But then from there, I want to work backwards, because I really like how you trace the history of this stuff. But let's start with Stargate. What was Stargate?
Well, Stargate, which had a couple of different names before it took on that name, also known as Grill Flame back in the early days, was a project that started in 1972 and ran until 1995 for our government. It was first conducted at SRI International, then called Stanford Research Institute, and then moved over to SAIC. And it went through a number of different project directors, including, I'm sure, people familiar with Russell Targ and Hal Puthoff, for example, and my co-author, Ed May, who was the project director from 1985 to 1995, though involved in 1975. It was a project that was really interested looking at the military intelligence gathering using extrasensory perception. So the application of ESP was the main goal for that. And out of that came what we have called remote viewing, which became popular even in the press with the more public experiments that were done by Targ and Puthoff back in the early 70s. So you might say that there was this program going on in the government through the military and defense department and eventually for CIA that paralleled the same researchers conducting more public research in the same topic, remote viewing. Methodologies in terms of how people do remote viewing, they were pretty much the same whether it was for military targets or the more public viewings that were done with people like Pat Price, who was a retired police commissioner back in the early days of the project. And what our project really was tasked with doing was typically not just testing out the limits of what remote viewing could do, but really applying what the viewers might be able to pick up on for military and other political targets, mostly in the Soviet Union during the Cold War, to add to our intelligence gathering process. They were usually given the missions of last resort, where all other intelligence resources have been actually exhausted. And some of those targets are still classified, some of those tasks are still classified, but a number of them are declassified. And of course, in the book, we talk about a whole bunch of the viewings that Joe McMonagle, who was viewer number one, and also Angela Ford, who was attached to the project, did.
Let's talk about some of those, because I think it then brings it down to a more concrete example of what we're talking about. So Joe McMonagle, who is really an interesting guy, he's been on the show, and just a thumbnail sketch of him. You know, what I thought was so interesting when we had him on is here's a guy who's in Army intelligence, has a near-death experience, was probably poisoned. The best guess he can make is he's probably poisoned by the East Germans in some kind of way that caused him to have a heart attack. Nonetheless, he has this incredible near-death experience, which totally conforms to so many of the other near-death experiences you hear about. And years later, he winds up in front of Targ and Puthoff doing this Stargate thing, and they pull out of his file Raymond Moody's book on near-death experience, and they say, you're the kind of people we want to target for this new thing we have called ESP espionage, you know, and he was remote viewer number one. So in the book, you document his amazing reading of a Soviet spy base. So this, I think, lays a perfect example at people's feet of what we're talking about. Lock this guy in a room in California and have him tell us what is in this Soviet spy base on the other side of the globe. So tell that story.
Well, you know, actually, the best example I think that's in the book is a submarine, which is technically was in a spy base. It was in a huge warehouse over in the Soviet Union, inland. It was inland about a mile or so from any water. And what happened with many of these tasks, and this was with any sort of location, whether it's a spy base or this warehouse, which housed that as well, we had spy satellites taking pictures over there. And there was, in the case of the submarine situation, there was this huge warehouse inland, and there was a lot of activity, military activity and construction activity going on. In any of the viewings that were given to the remote viewers, we didn't have any assets on the ground. We had no way of getting information. We didn't have, like, X-ray vision for the spy satellites. Consequently, what ended up was that these were situations of last resort. So Joe was tasked with trying to figure out what's inside this warehouse with all this activity going on. And he sits down and, as the remote viewers often do, kind of free associates. And what he ends up starting to draw, and we have the drawings in the book, and actually parts of the transcript in the book, which is one of the reasons I wanted to focus on this one, he starts drawing a double-hulled, huge submarine, something bigger than according to his dimensions, than ever had existed before outside of perhaps the Sea View on Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea on TV. And this was received by our intelligence folks, and of course they completely wrote it off as fantasy, because there's no way that the Soviets would have been building a submarine inside the land with no access to water. On top of that, Joe described some of the mechanisms and operation of the sub as being silent because of the types of engines it was going to have. 3 months later, as the Russians are digging a trench outside this big warehouse area, and then eventually roll out the first of what we call the Typhoon-class submarines, which you saw in the Hunt for Red October, the largest subs ever built. You know, they came back to him and pretty much verified that he was right on all accounts. And we were a little terrified of this submarine because it was not a sub that you could hear coming. Fortunately, you know, they're out of service now and have been for quite some time. There's only one still in existence at this point over in Russia.
Yeah. So an amazing account of just what we're talking about with this remote viewing idea. One of the angles in the book that's very interesting is you look at this not only from our perspective, but from the Soviet-Russian perspective as well, because it was long rumored that the whole impetus for these programs was a catch-up number on the Russians. You know, somebody came back and said, hey, we just heard that through our sources, our intelligence sources, that the Russians are using psychics for espionage. We better get on this too. So maybe tell us about what you found out in terms of whether or not that's true. But then more importantly, just a thumbnail sketch, if you will, of the Russian involvement with psychic espionage.
Well, it is true that we got involved in this partly because of fear that the Russians were getting somewhere. They had been spending effectively billions of dollars from the 60s onward. And there's an indication that part of how they even got involved in this, interestingly enough, is because we released intelligence that we were doing testing, which we were not doing in the early 60s, that scared the Russians into spending money and going in that direction. The idea being that this rumor that we would put out there to the Soviets would actually get them on a path of dead end. They'd spend money and time and energy on something that, according to our experts, probably had no validation whatsoever. And then we start hearing things from the Soviet Union, apparently, that they were having success. And, of course, back in the 70s, there was a book called Psychic Discoveries Behind the Iron Curtain, and a sequel to that with some journalists and other researchers from the U.S. who had gone over to visit the Soviet Union, and they'd been shown people who could do psychokinesis, mind over matter, and they were talked to about generators, psychotronic generators, mind-based generators, and there was discussion of mind control and also research in that area. So I guess you could say that scared the pants out of some people in our government, and this program was set up partly in response to what the Soviets were doing. But what's in the book is, and this is when I got involved in the project, I was absolutely fascinated to read the Russian accounts. Ed May, who is the lead author on the book, and Joe McMonagle had gone over to the Soviet Union in, actually it was Russia by the time they went over there. So after the fall, they got to know General Alexei Savin, who was running the psychic program at that time, the counterpart to Stargate. And because we were no longer enemies in the Cold War, there was a little bit more sharing of information. And so they got, through several visits, they got to know Joe's counterpart, reviewer over on that side of the world, and discussed techniques and such. And they learned an awful lot about what had gone on before, and how there had been 40-plus laboratories that had been set up to study this all over the Soviet Union, pretty much what they were looking at. And we have a lot of that commentary from a variety of Russian sources in the book, including a foreword by the man, General Nikolai Sham, who was the number two in the KGB during the fall, and a few other folks, General Savin, General Boris Ratnikov, who was a KGB man who was heavily involved in this as well. But from a snapshot perspective, what was going on there, it's kind of interesting. They had kind of bi-level programs happening. At the political level in the Soviet Union, you know, very materialistic. The government was very materialistic, but they were far from the godless communists that we continually heard about from our government in the 50s and 60s and 70s.
Right.
You know, Ed always talks about having visited the Kremlin. You can't find a church anywhere within a block of the Kremlin, but you go a couple blocks away and there's Russian Orthodox churches all over the place, and even Stalin apparently used to go to church at least twice a week, according to the Russians and other people over there. So they were far from that godless image. They had a very different cultural background. A lot of the folklore around psychic ability was still there. And so there was a bit of a belief pattern that existed below the official, we are materialistic, this does not exist, mind cannot go beyond the body, that sort of thing. And so there's kind of a split level of things happening. Officially, the KGB couldn't do anything. Officially, the government didn't do any research. Unofficially and through various scientific programs, they were actually sponsoring research in remote viewing, in psychotronic weaponry, which was essentially the idea of using creating non-lethal weapons using mind power alone, and even working on possibly of mind control, or at least influence they were looking for.
Lloyd, I was hoping you could really spend some time on those last two, that is the weaponizing of this psychic energy and the mind control, because what I found interesting is you kind of paint this picture where they went off in kind of this other direction that we weren't really going off on. But then I guess when you watch the movie, The Men Who Stare at Goats, we had kind of gone down that path too. It just was one of the paths that was maybe pruned off sooner than the others, but they had some success with this and were pursuing it. And then from their success, that paranoia kicked in and they said, well, we better figure out how to defend against it as well. So all that becomes an intriguing aspect of this.
Well, in our case, just to mention the Men Who Stare at Goats, the Earth First Battalion, that was kind of an unofficially, it was not a sanctioned group of people. It was folks in the Army who were trying that. And I actually knew one of the martial artists who worked with them. And there's a little bit of an exaggeration like we see on both sides in all of this. The Russians, as Ed May looked into this and Joe McLanahan, as we've heard from the Russians, what they were interested in was several things. They wanted to create devices that they could place or use. They could either place in the room or nearby when, let's say, that there was a conference with, this was going back to Reagan, and the idea to make Reagan sick or to push him in a certain direction for decision-making. It wasn't strictly the kind of mind control we think of in science fiction. It was more like mental influence or physical influence to make the person like back out of something. And they tried to create these devices that could be generated, you know, activated by psychokinesis or even work with telepathy. A Russian scientist by the name of Vasilyev had done some work in telepathic hypnosis, trying to actually do mind control by telepathy. And the big problem with that was he could actually cause people to or trigger a post-hypnotic suggestion, but it has to be a post-hypnotic suggestion. In other words, he would have to have hypnotized the person first, given them a post-hypnotic suggestion, and then trigger that by telepathy, which is kind of useless if you're trying to affect the other side in those cases.
Right.
The mind control didn't work so well. They didn't find some mental influence. And what all the researchers that were talked to have reported, and what all the evidence shows, is that they never did create or could create a psychotronic generator or a psychotronic weapon. It was all dead end for them. But the thing that I learned that was really interesting about the way the Russians were working, you know, when the folks went over for psychic discoveries in the Iron Curtain, they were told that they were having success in these areas. They came back with stories about the Russians getting way ahead of us, which actually kind of spurred the program even further here in the States. Problem is that they actually weren't. But what they also were not doing is they were not telling their government, the Russian scientists were not telling their government or their superiors that they were having no success because they wanted to keep the funding flowing. Mm-hmm. Consequently, when our folks came back, you might say it's propaganda towards the West, but it really was propaganda internally that we just happened to be involved in picking up on at the time. So just like people in our country cover their asses by making up stuff and continually talking about having success, they were doing the same thing at their 40-plus laboratories in these particular areas, in the meantime having success with the remote viewing in a couple of other areas.
You know, that's fascinating. And it's also fascinating how you have a little bit of inside information on the Men Who Stare at Goats thing, you know. And I do really enjoy absorbing in all that information. At the same time, as we were chatting a little bit about before the show, I always have to kind of catch myself and wait a minute and say, you know, wait a minute, we need to put this back into context. I mean, We are living in a science as we know it materialistic world that insists that even the first most basic element of this stuff doesn't exist, you know, and we are so enmeshed in that that sometimes we can't, I think, adequately absorb what we're being told here, which is, you know, just over the top, concrete, absolute evidence of the opposite of that. Now, one of the things that you do just a wonderful job in the book of doing is kind of putting this in a larger historical context, which I think really solidifies that understanding that, of course, this is going on. It's always been going on. It's always been at the forefront of any ruler's bag of tricks is, hey, if there's power out there, how can I use it? So can you maybe take us back? I know it's a huge step back, but you trace it in the book. The whole history of magic and the use of magic as part of warfare.
If you go to historically, anthropologically, you'll find, of course, with a lot of mythology, let's consider that, but historically and cross-culturally, as the anthropologists have found, and looking in the historical records we do actually have, we find, and it's no surprise to people, that kings and rulers and chieftains had witch doctors, they had shamans, they had prophets, they had wizards, they had people who were advising them that ostensibly had connection to greater sources of information and perhaps even the ability to alter the reality, you know, change the weather, attack people, put curses on people. That's been part of human belief since the very, very beginning. But what we have done, you know, what we do in parapsychology when in looking at those things is trying to see whether or not there's any examples of actual psychic functioning in some of them. My anthropology background at Northwestern, I was fascinated with everything from, you know, how shamans will heal people, but also put curses on people. You know, you hear about that, death by enchantment, that sort of thing. And there's a huge psychological element to that. But there are some examples where people were not told that they had a curse on them, and they still seem to succumb to it. And anthropologically, you find that sometimes it's because the person who was cursing them or did something to them actually introduced poison into their food. So you have the sorcery element of actual physical substances. The other side of it is that people sometimes are psychically aware that people are after them, and they may react in a negative way. So we have that kind of thing as well. There are some great examples in history of people really accessing information. There was the very famous Oracle at Delphi, for example, which many folks know about. And the Delphic Oracle spoke with supposedly the words of Apollo, and the Pythia, who is the person who breathed in some unusual fumes, and there's a big debate about what those fumes actually were and how much of an altered state the person was in, the Pythia was in. And then there were priests who would interpret what the Pythia actually said, and supposedly what Apollo said through the Pythia. One of the first examples of remote viewing in history, and it's probably one of the most widely known military predictions of that past, that time, it was King Croesus, who we hear of as, you know, the rich king, but there was a real King Croesus of Lydia who decided to test the oracle's powers before asking the oracle a question about some military campaign that he wanted to do against the Persians. And so first thing he did was send a runner to the Pythia, and the Pythia was to focus on an unknown target involving the king and pretty much describe it. In trance, the oracle described what she perceived, which was apparently related to the ruler having some turtle soup, actually described a reptile floating in water, in a liquid, and there was a lot more descriptive elements to it, but as it happens, at that moment in time, the prearranged time, King Croesus was having turtle soup. And it just kind of floored the king for the accuracy of the Pythia. So the military question went out. And the question was whether or not he will actually succeed, whether it be success in a military campaign against King Cyrus, who had founded the Persian Empire. And the oracles pretty much left him with a statement that if Croesus attacked Persia, there would be destruction of a great kingdom. And that maybe to do this, he needed to unite with the Greek states. Of course, destruction of a great kingdom, there's a problem with that. You have to ask a follow-up question. Whose great kingdom is going to be destroyed? And in this case, it was King Croesus's. one of the problems we have with psychic information is you can get some information, but it's very important to ask the next questions. Either what does it mean? What is that thing you've just drawn? You know, just continue to get further layers. And that's been very clear in the historical record for some of the things that went on. You also look cross-culturally, and back in college I did a project looking at divination techniques of various indigenous peoples around the world and how they used them, you know, might have used them psychically, where psychic ability might have fallen. And one of the ones I remember distinctly was the Laplanders going looking for caribou, actually, or for reindeer, and you know, the migration patterns would shift according to the food, and the shaman would actually take a caribou bone or reindeer bone and throw it into the fire, and then a thigh bone, and pull it out and look at the cracks and read the cracks like a map and send the hunters after the herd. And inevitably they would use that as a map and find the herd almost every time. At least those are the reports. Now, the bone only cracks so many ways. There are only so many patterns that can actually happen. And that means that the shaman was doing something, reading into the bone in a way that was not a pattern indicative of the cracking of the bone from the flame. That was a psychic
right.
hit.
Well, we see that over and over again. I mean, whatever vehicle or, I guess, kind of enabling little device is used doesn't really speak to what's really happening in terms of accessing that information, which we have no idea how it does. And I think there's a couple of really interesting interplays that maybe we'll touch on later as we talk about magic and mentalist activities and mentalism as well. But one is, you know, there's two ways to look at this, is to look back historically and look for evidence of the reality of the phenomena that we can then, you know, project forward and go, see, it happened back then and it happened now. I actually think it's better to go the other way around and say, okay, look at what SRI did in terms of investigating this as thoroughly as they could with the Stargate program. Look at Joe McGonigal. Look at all these readings that were done that people can attest to, that there's just no way to account for the amazing information that they were able to glean. And let's kind of nail that down and say, okay, something is happening. People are able to, in some anomalistic way that we don't understand, access information. And then let's go back and look at the history. And I think we have to look at these questions and say, well, clearly the history then reads as if there is some reality to it. But as you just pointed out in the, I thought it was great, your story about the Soviets kind of fudging the numbers to get the funding. There's also the kind of fakery and corruption, the human element of this, that we would have to expect would come with it. I mean, if all of a sudden you're a guy who's starving in the forest, and the next thing you know, you're eating with the king, and the king is bending down to hear every word from your mouth about what he should do, I mean, you don't want that to stop. So if the information isn't flowing today, baby, you better make it flow one way or another. And it's really, that to me seems like a much more plausible explanation of the fakery and corruption that we see. Just like your story about the Soviets, like, of course, you know, I'm going to make sure that my job continues and that my lifestyle continues, rather than worry about the big picture in terms of the results that I'm getting from this little experiment and trial that I did. Do you want to speak to that at all in terms of how fakery probably works its way into this equation and has always worked its way into this phenomena?
Well, I think it's worked its way into just about every area of human endeavor.
That's true.
You know, we're parapsychologists are yelled at by the skeptics, the so-called skeptics. We're always dealing with fake psychics and such, and they don't really look at our actual research methodology, which is a lot tighter than most sciences in general, especially for the last 20 years, because of issues of potential fraud and sensory leakage. We have to be careful. But you find fraud in every area of human endeavor. And a lot of times it's just simply to keep their jobs. I mean, it's not necessarily to, you know, it's not the kind of fraud that we hear with fake psychics who try to take $50,000 from someone, try keeping them on the take, so to speak, on the hook. But the fakery that the Russians did was kind of understandable also because, let's face it, they were kind of under the pressure of producing something, even though it was an official, without being sent to a gulag someplace.
Right.
They had that other kind of political pressure. It wasn't just producing to keep the money flowing. There's a little bit more to it. And one of the researchers actually, one of the Russian researchers pointed out that, or mentioned that when his lab did occasionally accept supposed inventions of psychotronic generators from people, because the word had gone out that people should try to be independent inventors and try to develop their own devices. And they would show up at the lab and hand them over to a receptionist or someone who would say, yes, we'll test them. And then they'd turn around and just throw everything in a storeroom without ever even looking at it, because by that time they'd already figured out that these things didn't work. So there's that going on. Scientifically, you know, you look at the actual data itself, we have to be careful within our field to make sure that the information is correct in controlled experiments. And going to the Russian side of things, as Ed and Joe work with them, you know, everything was taken probably with a little grain of salt. We had some stories that we didn't put in the book because they were a little bit wild. And even the Russians said these are wild stories. And that kind of indicated that there's probably, they're having maybe a little bit of fun with us in some instances. So they focused on the ones that they could verify and the ones that and talking to people who were actually directly involved in the situations quite a bit. Through history, we do have the advisors who use magic tricks and cold reading and any other number of ways to keep themselves going, and some of them probably didn't do a good job and ended up having their heads cut off along the way. Others may have just simply moved on, but that's just general human nature, and we see that, again, in almost every endeavor. It happened in the healing arts quite a bit, in fact. And, you know, there's still a little bit of that in the healing arts today, in medicine today quite a
sure.
bit.
Sure. Well, both in our sanctioned established medicine, conventional medicine, as well as the alternative medicine. I mean,
oh, absolutely. You know, I find it fascinating that we have a benchmark for medical research, for pharmaceutical research, called the placebo effect. And yet medicine has no idea how that works.
Exactly.
And there's very little actual research in the placebo effect. So the benchmark for putting drugs out is an effect that no one understands, that is definitely mind-body, and that's about as far as they'll go with it. But that's kind of absurd when you think about it, even more absurd than some of the things that come out of programs like Stargate and the Russian program.
It's especially absurd in that the placebo effect itself completely undermines the fundamental principle of our paradigm, and that is that there is no mind-body connection because there is no mind. Your mind is solely a product of your brain. It's purely material. It's a biological robot kind of thing. Your mind can do no work. If your mind can do work, any work at all, it violates the whole idea of mind equals brain. So, yeah, it's
right.
Paradox absurdity inside of absurdity. You know, the other interesting things along around the medical thing, and I don't know if you've looked at it, but you also have the decline effect, you know, which no one can explain. You obviously know, but
which, you know, honestly, that effect came from J.B. Ryan.
Exactly.
J.B. Ryan is the first person who actually pointed at any kind of decline effect. Now it's back in the 1930s.
Talk a little bit about that and the history of J.B. Ryan. Since, are you still on the board of directors of the J.B. Ryan Research Institute?
The Ryan Research Center? Yes,
so I am. Tell us a little bit about your involvement there and the history, which is amazing, an amazing history. And we've touched on it a couple times in the show, but probably not thoroughly enough. And then roll that right into the decline effect. It's amazing in his research.
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting. Until probably maybe 10 years ago, most people, if you mentioned parapsychology research, they would immediately say, well, you mean they're doing it at Duke University. And that's because of J.B. Ryan, that association. He and his wife, Louisa, and William, the psychologist, William McDougall, came to Duke in the early 30s, and Ryan had an interest for a few years, both Ryans and McDougall, in psychic phenomena, partly because of the age of spiritualism, which was the spiritualist mediums that was still happening even through the 1920s.
And let me just interject, correct me if I'm wrong, but yeah. McDougall cut his teeth as a debunker, as an exposer of fraud, right?
Yeah, a lot of the researchers actually did that by that time, because there were so many frauds out there that it was hard to even find anybody who might have some genuine ability. They're all definitely doing that. In fact, the Ryans looked at the incident with Marjorie, the medium Marjorie, who was actually featured on the recent Houdini movie that appeared on History Channel, History 2, a couple weeks ago. And this was, you know, Houdini's archenemy. This is one of his big cases towards the end of his life. And this was a woman who was convincing a lot of researchers that there was a lot of hanky-panky going on. It was a kind of a big scandal even within the parapsychological community at the time, and the Rhines didn't want to have anything to do with it. JB decided that he'd really want to bring this into the laboratory. There had been some laboratory research done by a couple of folks, including a guy named John Coover at Stanford University in the teens, but for the most part, most of the research was out in the field, in the seance room, and or just examining people outside. He and McDougall really wanted to bring it into the laboratory, and so they did. They set up a parapsychology laboratory, and Ryan, rather than working with gifted subjects, although he had a few of those, really wanted to look at the incidence of ESP and eventually psychokinesis in average people and make it a number, you know, really like psychological research in general, look at the statistical possibilities for people doing ESP. And out of that early work came things like the Zener cards with a gent by the name of Carl Zener, because they wanted some symbols or images that had very little emotionality to them, which also could be scored very easily. They, because of a gambler who claimed he was able to influence the roll of dice, they started doing dice rolling, both predictive for precognition, but also with PK, trying to see if people could influence the dice to come up a certain number every single time. And these were done under controlled conditions, meaning somebody observed at least some sensory controls and some interactive controls with the PK to make sure that the person wasn't touching the dice. In all of this work that they did, they found that you could sit somebody down and do a bunch of ESP tests with the cards. And the more you did that, somebody might have started out scoring phenomenally well. And by that, I mean maybe 15 out of 25, which is really, really amazing considering chances 4, 5, or 6. But after a while, because you have to do a numbers game, you can't just test them once. You know, luck says that every once in a while you're going to be lucky and you're going to get a bunch in a row. So you'd have to do hundreds of these trials. And after testing these people, Ryan and his other researchers noticed that there was a decline in the results towards chance. So eventually the person's score went back to chance. And they looked at it in a lot of different contexts. We look at it as a potential relationship to being bored. You know, it's a human performance issue, where if you can excel at the beginning, but the odds are you're not going to continue to excel, especially if you're in a task that's extremely boring. And that is something that's kind of jumped into other fields of science, as you mentioned.
Well, and just let me interject, because I don't think we know conclusively that last part. You know what just caught my...
No, we don't. No, that's just the thought.
I mean, maybe it's boredom. Maybe it's something else. Because whenever we step into this other realm, we have to, you know, all bets are off. And that's why science tries to pull us back to materialism, because even though it might not be an accurate representation of the world, at least it's one that we can measure. You know, and that has a certain comfort factor that we all have. You know, what I was alluding to, and I'm sure you ran across it too, you know, there's this article in the New Yorker magazine. It's a great article by this guy named...
Oh, yeah, that's a great article. Yeah.
Joan Allaire, and he wrote this article, The Truth Wears Off, and it's these bunch of pharmaceutical guys getting together and telling the dirty little secret that these drug studies that they have from 10 years ago that shows a certain efficacy of I think it's antidepressant medicine, hey, that wears off over time, and not in a way that we can explain. I mean, it's kind of in the,
right,
you know, Sheldrick morphic field 100th monkey kind of way that... So even if you take a separate population, so let's say you have this drug, this antidepressant drug, and you give it to a certain population, and it's effective, next year it's effective. What they found is 10 years down, even if you go to another population that's never been exposed to this drug, hey, it's less effective. The bump that you got in kind of torquing the consciousness field, if you will, has kind of worn off and pulled it back to the median. And it's not like two out there woo-woo guys, you and I, talking about this. This is Eli Lilly sitting around and going, don't let this story get out. But there's some inexplicable way that these drugs are less effective over time. And it's just like you were saying, Lloyd, about the placebo effect. I mean, we have it down now to where people talk about the placebo effect as if it's some well-established principle of science that we can rest on. And all it says is there's more mystery than we can even, you know, begin to absorb, just even within what we already claim we know.
Yeah, and it's just crazy. You know, there's a placebo effect, there's a nocebo effect, there's a negative results as well. And whether it's mind-body, you know, if it's psychological, whatever is going on, it's crazy that it's the benchmark against. They'll do a clinical trial, and the drug is 10% more effective than placebo. Consequently, they'll release a drug at a high expense. Well, you know, that 10% is not a very big margin,
right,
and it declines, whereas the placebo effect, at least as best we know, doesn't decline.
Right, right. So it's like we're going to take our non-magic, test it against, or then factor in the magic factor just by putting a little asterisk at the end of our results, and then go ahead and, you know, push it out there and then claim it's all non-magic. But wait a minute, what about that asterisk there called placebo that is the magic factor that you don't want to look at?
Which typically has fewer side effects than most of the drugs. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. Getting back to the rhymes, one of the other things that came out of the early research at the lab, the Duke Parapsychology Lab, which, by the way, existed until 1965, and it closed, although perhaps Duke was happy that it closed, because Ryan had got such notoriety, even to the point where his data was looked at by the American College of Mathematicians in the 50s and said, the statistics are good, ESP exists. I mean, that pronouncement was made based on the numbers and probabilities back then. But when it closed, it was because Ryan retired, and then he founded the Foundation for Research on the Nature of Man and the Institute for Parapsychology, which today is the Ryan Research Center. But in that process, other things were considered. There was something called an experimenter effect that was noted, and that's something that we look at quite a bit. And there's two levels of experimenter effect in parapsychology. One is a more psychological effect, which, again, it came out of parapsychology. It's been regularly accepted in other fields as well, at least the social sciences, and that is, if you've got a white lab-coated, very unemotional experimenter who takes you through the experiment versus a very cheerful, bubbly, happy, friendly experimenter not wearing the white lab coat, even with rats, humans and rats do better with the happy one. So there's this a performance issue that happens, and that's the one level. And I've talked to people in the physical sciences who say that there's, you know, have told me that there's an experimenter effect that they won't talk about. They don't talk about the same way. But there are certain things. I knew a guy who was a chemist at one of the national labs who said that he and a few others working with a professor that they had done some chemistry experiments with, they were trying to replicate one of his experiments, and they couldn't get it to work at all. And it was apparently something about how he poured one chemical into another. It's something that you don't write down on paper. So there's that kind of experimenter effect, too. It's kind of like the finesse of things. Parapsychology also has the experimenter effect related to potential psychokinesis and ESP in general, in that we may be influencing the actual physical experiment so that it comes out successfully in certain times, certain aspects when we join in with certain subjects, which is why we're doing triple blind and even further blind experiments to remove the designer of the experiment and everybody from who knows anything about it from even the proximity of any of the subjects that are being worked with, any of the volunteers.
Well, yeah, and that's much needed work, and it's really great work, and I commend you for it and the folks who are out there toiling away at it. You got to wonder at the same time exactly what we're trying to kind of wrestle in there, and there's a certain chaos theory aspect of it, you know, the butterfly wing kind of thing. Floats the dewdrop, falls off the butterfly this way or that way, and it changes this complex system that we have, and we don't know. So we're just kind of fooling with the alligator clips, putting them here and there and trying to measure the best we can.
Oh, yeah.
And that's an admirable effort, but we have to start with, we don't really understand the phenomena of consciousness. So we don't even understand, you know, which end of the telescope. I keep mixing all these metaphors. I'm going to drive people nuts. But we don't know which end of the telescope we're looking at. You know, we're assuming that we're in here and the world's out there and we can measure it. And we may just be in this consciousness soup and we don't totally understand that. So is there a place for parapsychology in there to do this kind of work with statistics, or is that kind of a fool's errand?
Well, you know, this, frankly, the statistics really have been used partly as a tool to understand the effect size, but also partly for evidence. And we're at a point, and many of us have concluded this, and not necessarily everybody in the field agrees, but we're certainly at a point where we have more than enough evidence, and we really need to focus more on finding people who will make better subjects or better studies so that we can learn how this all works. So we actually figure out what the extent of it is, so we can find out what other ways we can apply different talents of ESP and potentially psychokinesis. And, you know, the statistics, frankly, to me, have always been a little boring. I've not really been as interested in that. It's one of the reasons I've been doing field studies for so long. And it's the success rate. It's actually, the proof is in the pudding. It's what you end up with. And, for example, in the remote viewing programs, at least here in the States, they had more than 15% of the viewings providing actionable intelligence, meaning intelligence or information as good, if not better, than what they already had and as good as an on-the-ground asset so they could actually act on it. However, the biggest problem is that in the intelligence world, they never act on, well, I can't say never because we saw this happen in Iraq. Normally, they wouldn't act on something from one source, whether it was ESP or an on-the-ground asset. They would have to confirm it some other way. And you know, the stats, the success rate of 15 to 20% apparently with the remote viewing program, considering they were given the tasks of last resort, the ones where they'd exhausted all other intelligence gathering means, that's a pretty high number, especially since the number at the time in the 80s and 90s apparently was about the same for on the ground and other assets that we had in delivering intelligence, about 15 to 20%.
Yeah, that is amazing. This book is really one that anyone who's looked into this topic is going to find just fascinating and chock full of a ton of great little anecdotes and stories that fill in a lot of the gaps. Again, it's ESP Wars East and West, and you can find it on Amazon. You know, something else that you've been involved with for a long time, Lloyd, and I think is another great area of controversy and intrigue, and that's the whole mentalist magician thing. And you actually you were the president of the Mentalist Association. What was that?
Psychic Entertainers Association.
Psychic. Yeah. So who would be some psychic entertainers that we would know of?
Well, I'll mention one that's not a member of the organization. That would be the amazing Kreskin. But the folks who are in our group, one of our prominent members here in the States is Mark Salem, who's had a few TV specials. Alain New, who's also had a few TV shows. We've had Craig Cargis and Chris Carter, who are both very active on the college circuit. We're not, the people who are mentalists tend not to get the kind of TV shows typically that the big magicians do, because we don't have as big shows. The shows are not as big. They're a little bit different. But there's in our organization, there's a little over 250 people around the world. We have Anthony Blake from Spain, who is the leading mentalist and one of the leading celebrities, in fact, in Spain. Lior Menor in Israel, one of the major mentalists there. We have folks from Germany, Finland, England, a lot in England, and a few other places as well. And, you know, we're a little different than the magic organizations, even though some people will kind of equate the two, because of the nature of what we perform, which looks a little bit more real than cutting a woman in half, certainly.
But I know from Penn and Teller that all that mentalist stuff is fake. It's an illusion. It's Las Vegas show stuff, right?
It's not that. I mean, that's the thing. Penn and Teller, as you know, Penn has a very specific agenda of his own.
Does he really? What is his agenda?
Very similar to the Amazing Randys. You know, he's very, very down on anything that smacks of psiability. And even though we're not talking about this being psychic, people do believe what we do might be real. And in fact, there's a big backlash amongst many magicians against mentalism, because we end up with audiences who don't walk away. You know, hopefully if they've seen a magic show, they've been entertained. But other than little kids and an occasional adult, it's pretty rare, nobody in that audience believes that what David Copperfield does is real, that it's all illusion. Whereas for good or for bad, when people see our shows, they may think that, they may even argue, and I've had arguments with people telling me how great a psychic I am, and I'm telling them, well, no, it's not. It's psychological. There's a lot more to it. And it's not stage illusion or sleight of hand the way that magicians go into things. We have a lot more going for us in the observational, interactional, psychological area than magicians ever do.
And correct me if I'm wrong, Lloyd, but there are some people among the mentalist community and among the magicians who have reported various times in their career when a truly unexplainable aspect of this played a part in what they did.
Absolutely. I've talked to many magicians over the years, since the early 80s, some top people, in fact, who had had things happen to them in the middle of their acts. When something was clearly broken, to have that still work is pretty damned amazing. And that happens to mentalists, certainly. One of my buddies actually does metal bending, kind of like Geller used to do as part of his act. And he does it through, you know, manipulation and other ways. But he'll have a spread of silverware on a table, and every so often, he's told me, the audience members will point at what's going on the table, and there are things bending on the table. And, of course, he doesn't know if he's doing it, if an audience member is doing it, but they're not being bent by trickery. It's happening for real in that circumstance. And he just kind of goes with that. Mentalists tend to know to go with that and kind of take credit for it, even if we may not have actually done it. Mentalists often, there are many people who do mental acts who have said that in the middle of their act, they'll get a flash of something in their mind. They'll, you know, a phone number, a person's name, a birth date, even driver's license number, just things will pop in. And because of the nature of our acts, we can say that stuff. And if it's wrong, it's, you know, it's wrong. In fact, since ESP is not 100%, it actually even looks better if we're wrong every once in a while. Whereas magicians can't be wrong. That's the biggest difference. They're doing a trick, and the trick should work. We're not necessarily doing tricks.
Is that
even reading people?
Is that really the history of this kind of schism with the magic community in terms of this? It's been so pronounced in the last 20 or 30 years, the just hostility towards anything that's traditionally magic, and to completely replace it with this materialistic, it's not materialistic, with this kind of Randy, Penn and Teller, it can only be this way kind of magic. What is the history of that?
Yeah. You know, it's a real shame that in the magic world there's been this push towards calling everything a trick and not even necessarily using the word illusion. There's no, I don't know, it's like they're not appealing to people's sense of wonder. If you remember Doug Henning, he was a great storyteller and really appealed to hitting people's sense of wonder, to suspending their disbelief for the time, so that at least while you're in his show, he really wanted you to believe that this was real. Whereas we don't see that, and certainly don't see that with Penn and Teller. They're entertainers, and they are entertaining, but it's a different kind of entertainment than what somebody like Henning or even Harry Blackstone Jr. and some of the older magicians might have done in years gone by. Fortunately, there are a few people who are like that still around, but not a whole lot. And it's very difficult for us in the mentalism world. We see magicians trying to do mentalism as if they're tricks and not getting the idea that this is, you know, you really have to hit people's sense of wonder. It's about the performance. It's not necessarily about the trick.
Mm-hmm. And I can't leave this interview without touching on this chocolatier thing. How did you get interested in that, and what do you do?
Well, you know, and there is a connection between chocolates and parapsychology, by the way.
Oh, you got to tell us.
Yeah. But I'm a food guy and a wine guy, and years ago, when we started having artisan chocolate here in the United States, I started really getting interested in that, having really great chocolate for the very first time, not just the crappy mass-produced stuff that was out there was a big thing. And it's partly probably because I live in the Bay Area, and we have the wineries around us, so I'm also a wine guy, and it just kind of fell into naturally there. I started learning about the history of chocolate and about how it's made, and it was pretty fascinating stuff, even the politics around the world around this. And one of my publishers published a book back in 2005 called A Paranormal Casebook with a bunch of my ghost cases, and the publisher there was also into chocolate, and we were sitting and talking, and she thought that I ought to eventually write a book about how I learned to be so knowledgeable about chocolate. And I started on a path to every so often touch on that book, although hopefully this year I'll actually get it done. Had a lot of other things drop in the way. But I did start doing chocolate tasting presentations, so really guided chocolate tastings, and finding that I enjoyed doing that since I enjoy speaking, and certainly the audience did. And as part of all this, I interviewed a number of the major chocolatiers here in the Bay Area and elsewhere, and it was Joseph Schmidt, who's been around for a number of years in the chocolate world, who on his tour of his factory in San Francisco when it existed, he said, you know, if you're going to write this book or work on this, you really should learn to make chocolate yourself. And I mentioned that to my wife, and it's an anniversary present. She found a chocolate course for me to take, and I went through it and really enjoyed it. So every so often I will make chocolates. I'm making special chocolates for the Forever Family Foundation's annual conference, which is coming up in November in North Carolina, Durham, in fact. We're going to do something with the Rhine Center there, too. And I make chocolates very often, ghost drops and other kinds of chocolates, mostly dark chocolates of different flavors. And it's kind of a fun thing to do. But the research end of things, Dean Radin, who you know, had done research with chocolate and putting intention into chocolate a number of years ago, back in 2006. And it was a pilot study, which one of these days I hope to get the funding up to do a really big study beyond a pilot study to see, it's going to replicate that, because what he found was that if you kind of meditate over, or he had many different conditions, put a message in the chocolate, so to speak, people eating the chocolate compared to a controlled batch of chocolate from the same manufacturer, same batch, had significant mood enhancement and energy enhancement. And that was only over a couple day period. So as if the people were picking up on the message in the chocolate.
Amazing. Very, very interesting stuff. Hey, Lloyd, where can people go to learn more about what's going on with you and keep up with the latest?
My main website is mindreader.com, and that'll list any events coming up and such. My classes, I teach classes both local and distance, teach a lot of distance classes, both for HCH Institute, which is here in the Bay Area, and also for the Rhine Research Center. And I also have my chocolate website, which is hauntedbychocolate.com, where people can find out about that.
Great, great. And as well, folks, check out ESP Wars East and West. You can find it on Amazon. I think you'll really enjoy it if you're at all interested in this topic. Lloyd, it's been so great having you on. It's long overdue. You have so much knowledge of this area. We'll have to have you back on. Just let us know when you have a new book, or maybe this book on chocolates or something. We can talk about that. But do keep in touch.
Sure. Thank you, Alex.
Thank you. Thanks again to Lloyd Arbuck for joining me today on Skeptico. I guess the one question I'd have to tee up from this interview is Lloyd's historical perspective on the use of parapsychology, or on the use of these phenomena that we associate with parapsychology, ESP, precognition, other psychic abilities, and how those have been used throughout time by governments, kings, people in power to influence the outcome of history, be it wars or be it strategic political moves. There's really a lot of history behind this, and I think that it's very easy to dismiss that history as folklore, or more often as the superstitions of the uneducated, which we often do. And I think one thing that this interview and this work on Stargate really brings into focus is that maybe we should take a completely different perspective on that and say that since this phenomena is real, then why would we assume it hasn't cropped up in history before? So if you can untangle that question for me, as Michael in our forum so often does, I think there's two or three in there, but you get the general idea. What do you make of the application of these kind of parapsychological ESP-related phenomena in history past? So that's the question. Love to hear any thoughts you have on that. Of course, the place to do that is through the Skeptico website at skeptiko.com. where you can leave a comment there on the website, jump on over to the forum and join the discussion there, or always you can send an email or link me up on Facebook. So I have a number of interesting shows coming up, and as I mentioned, John McGuire is helping me get these out, so I'm hoping that we'll be on a once-a-week publishing schedule here for a while, probably through the end of the year. Might take an extra week off during the Christmas break, but maybe not. And then there's just much, much more Skeptico to come. So stay with me for all of that. Until next time, take care and bye for now.